Beware, for I am fearless and therefore powerful. 2018 marks the 200th anniversary of Frankenstein. Readers and scientists across the globe celebrate Mary Shelley's look at love and fear, power and humanity. October 16th at 6 p.m. Mountain, the next STEAM Cafe presents Dr. Laura Kremel from the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology Humanities Department, and she's joining us today from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital Studio at SDPB's Black Hills Studio in downtown Rapid City. Laura Kremel, thanks for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Frankenstein. Gee, where do we even begin? Let's go back in time a little bit and tell me, you know, 200 years ago when this was written is a very different time scientifically.
Yes.
How do you approach that, two centuries old approach to science?
So one of the big misconceptions about this novel is that Mary Shelley must have been very anti-technology, very anti-science to write this kind of warning text, warning us against scientific expression, scientific advancement. But she actually was not. She was extremely knowledgeable in the updated science of the day. She would attend lectures. She read all the latest writings. She grew up in a very philosophical household with two very famous academics herself. So people were always visiting who were in the know in terms of the science. So the science that she incorporates into the novel is the science that they were talking about at the day. And so she comes from that place of knowledge where it sounds very science fiction to us. Those were the experiments that they were attempting themselves in the day.
All right, give me an example of that. What was the science of the day that you might see a connection to in what's happening in Frankenstein?
Well, they were experimenting with electricity, as we've seen in all the famous Frankenstein movies. They
right.
had discovered a battery. They were attempting to bring bodies back to life or to reanimate bodies. So they were starting very small with something called galvanism, which is sending a current through something in order to animate it. So one very famous experiment was with frogs' legs. They would reanimate them using electricity. And they started to push this a little bit too far, and people started to get a little bit nervous. There was one particular experiment that was done on a human corpse, and at the time, physicians were not allowed to experiment with bodies the way that we think of. They didn't have people donating their bodies to science when they died, so they were really only allowed to experiment with the bodies of criminals who had been executed. So there was one particular experiment where they were trying to bring an executed criminal back to life, and it started to look like it was working. They hooked up these currents to the body, the face kind of convulsed, the limbs convulsed, and people were terrified. And they kind of stopped doing it as much at that point because they started to think, well, if we bring this body back to life, what happens to that person? Is it still a criminal? Do we have to execute them again? Do they have a place in society? They hadn't actually thought about what happens next. They were just so focused on, can we do this? And so Shelley knew about those experiments. And of course, the most terrifying part of her novel for people of the day was that she succeeded.
Right. So here's the sort of a look at ethics of the time. And then, you know, we talk about it 200 years later because it's a fabulous book and it has endured. But we also are having some of those same ethical conversations about what we can do and what we should do.
Yes, absolutely. And I think when I teach this novel, that is one of the things that my students connect to the most.
Tell me a little bit about the classes that you teach and how they fit into the overall, you know, engineering and science and, you know, programs at Mines and where that intersection with the humanities is.
So I'm teaching two different classes right now at two opposite sides of the spectrum. One is mostly freshmen and the other is mostly upperclassmen. The freshman class is a composition class, which is teaching them how to write. So it seems like an odd place to insert Frankenstein. But the novel has several frame narratives within it. It's actually the entire story is told through a series of letters. And they're written by an explorer of the North Pole who is himself kind of pushing boundaries in a way that Victor Frankenstein pushes boundaries. And so it's a perfect novel for thinking about different types of rhetorical argument, what kinds of arguments are the characters making to one another, what kinds of arguments are they making to themselves, how do they look at evidence in the time period when they are supporting these arguments. So we're using it for those rhetorical strategies in the composition classes. My upper level course is on the Gothic tradition, so we are reading kind of a chronological list of all the big texts. So we're just finishing this one this week. And in that class, we're kind of putting this in the context of what is this Gothic tradition? How does it fit? And this is really the first novel to really bring in that science element that I mentioned, to really rely on it for the plot, real science that was happening in the day. So that's a new thing for the Gothic in terms of this is the scary part. It's not so much ghosts. It's not so much the supernatural. Mm-hmm. The supernatural becomes replaced by science in this new kind of Gothic literature.
So what kind of impact does the Gothic tradition have on science itself? Does it sort of, you know, delay things because people are connecting science with, you know, mischief and mayhem and unethical decisions at the time?
I don't think it has. Well, it does have that impact to some extent, but it also presents kind of experiments, imaginary experiments, that you wouldn't be able to perform in, you know, in the material life. So it's kind of trying out things. What if we brought a body back to life? What if we did this? And that can be very inspiring for some. So for example, I know that the creator of The Pacemaker saw the 1931 Frankenstein film, and that's where he got his inspiration to create this life-saving technology, is that he saw this movie over and over again and was inspired by that science, which was a little bit scary, but it also presented some possibilities that arise when you kind of allow yourself to be scared.
Right. How, what do you know about Mary Shelley and how the book was received at the time? Was it popular right away?
It was not popular right away. It was disturbing. It kind of drawed on some of those fears that they saw happening in science. So it was not extremely well received at the time. It wasn't popular until they put it on the stage, really, in the 1820s. And there were also some questions about who wrote it, because it was first published anonymously, and some thought that her husband, Percy Bysshe Shelley, wrote it. Some thought that someone else wrote it. It was a little bit up in the air as to who wrote it. When they found out that it was written by a woman, that also presented other complexities that they were not too happy with.
Right. Partially because a woman's not supposed to be having these thoughts.
Correct.
How dare she? All
yes.
Right. So let's talk about some of the lessons for today, because a lot of people look at Frankenstein today and use it to talk about issues of artificial intelligence and machine learning and where we're going in the future. Are those fair comparisons?
I think they're absolutely fair questions. And the novel presents us with that question over and over again. How far should we be pushing something? How responsible are we for what happens next? Should there be limits? Should we be responsible? Whether we are and whether we should be are two completely different questions. But then it also has a lot of broader lessons as well in terms of what makes us human. Is this creation, does it qualify as human? Should it? And if not, why not? And so it also opens up questions of difference and how difference is constructed. How do we respond to difference? And those are kind of broader questions that anyone can think of, you know, scientists and creators alike.
Do you find that your students are making those connections, you know, on their own? Do you have to guide them to that? I guess what I'm wondering is, are they making those connections to their own work? And how are you seeing some of those connections to their own studies and their future careers sort of showing up? What do you hope they take from Frankenstein into the world of, you know, of work after School of Mines?
I think they are picking up on it. I've taught it more frequently in my freshman class than I have this upper level class, just because I teach the freshman class more frequently. So I see them a lot when they're at the beginning of their career at Mines. And so they do think about it. And last semester I had them write a paper that was directed at Mines students, fellow Mines students, kind of recommending the novel. Why should Mines students read this novel? And a lot of them came up with something similar to, this will help us think of ethics in our careers. This will help us consider what is the responsibility, because without that consideration, you could end up with a monster and not know how to deal with it.
Mm. And the monster itself has such a person. I mean, you see that sort of, the suffering.
Yes.
It takes on, this humanity as well to get at some of those deeper questions.
Yes, and they're shocked by that, actually, yeah. That part of the novel. They've seen the films, maybe. They've certainly seen Frankenstein in popular culture. That's one of the really amazing things about this book, is you can know so much about Frankenstein without ever having seen a movie, without ever having read the book. And so in the novel, the creature is very articulate and very smart. It's not kind of this hulking beast that we see in the films or that we see in popular culture, and they are shocked by how empathetic this creature is and how much they connect to the creature more than the creator.
Hmm. do you make those connections to, contemporary versions of the story, Ex Machina or, other movies and films and books that authors are still... I guess what I'm wondering is, do we have a new Gothic tradition now that you can make connections with?
Well, Jurassic Park comes up pretty much over and over again in this context, especially the famous speech about you were so busy worrying about whether you could bring these dinosaurs into being, you weren't focused on whether you should have done it, and that is kind of the core question. So that film comes up because students know it very well. They know the sequels. So that's the one that comes up the most frequently. Today in class, actually, in about an hour and a half, we will be talking about other adaptations in my upper level class. So we'll see what they come up with.
Because I'm just saying Ex Machina freaked me out. So
I actually haven't seen it.
You need to watch
so,
that one.
Yeah, I've been told that
very
I need to
well
watch
done.
It.
Yes, very well done. Who are the other Gothic tradition authors? What other books connect to Frankenstein of the day?
Well, Mary Shelley was extremely well read, of course. So she read all of the kind of, it was a dark and dreary night kind of books that we think of represent the core Gothic tradition. And that's how she wanted to write her novel. That's how she starts it before she added the letters kind of surrounding it. And so she knew about, for example, Castle of Otranto, which was the first Gothic novel. She knew about The Monk, which was a very scandalous Gothic novel of the time. She had read all these. Her mother had written several things that kind of edged on the side of Gothic, and so she knew her mother's work extremely well. Her mother was Mary Wollstonecraft, who died a few days after giving birth to her. So she knew about, and that was a particularly gendered version of the Gothic that kind of was almost too close for comfort in many ways. So all those texts that came before her, she was very aware of.
Well, I just want to come take this class, but we'll have to settle for coming to the Steam Cafe. And that is at 6 p.m. October 16th. And Dr. Laura Kremel from South Dakota School of Mines and Technology from the Humanities Department there giving that lecture. That's at Hay Camp Brewing, right?
Yes.
Excellent. All right. Is it true, by the way, that Mary Shelley wrote this as part of a competition?
Oh, yes, it definitely is.
Tell us that story because it's so good. Tell us before we go.
Yeah, it's a fantastic story. So she wrote it when she was 18, extremely young, so kind of perfect for talking to my students about this because it is their age that she wrote this book. She suffered incredible loss in her life. She had just lost a child. She had just given birth to another one. She was in kind of a... not a great headspace, and they didn't know about depression. They didn't know about postpartum depression in particularly. So they kind of went on this holiday, and she was with Percy Bysshe Shelley, who she was not yet married to, but she would be, and they were at Lake Geneva. They were meeting their friend Byron there, Lord Byron, who many say is kind of the first celebrity. He's a character all by himself. And they were also joined by Byron's doctor, Polidori. And so it was 1816, commonly known as the year without a summer, because a volcano had erupted the year previously, and it had affected the weather so badly that there was still ash in the air. There was very little sun, lots and lots of rain. Byron actually wrote an amazing poem called Darkness about the famine that occurred because of this. But they were kind of cooped up. They couldn't go outside because of this year without a summer, and reading ghost stories to each other, as one does. And they were all writers. So they all said, well, let's write our own ghost story, and we'll have a competition and see whose is the best. Mary was really the most successful of all of them, obviously. Shelley wrote a few things, but he didn't really finish them. Byron started a fragment about a vampire. He didn't really finish that either, but it's still read. It's still included in some publications. His doctor, Polidori, wrote the first European vampire novella. Predates Dracula, huge influence on Dracula, simply called The Vampire. And then, of course, Mary wrote Frankenstein during that summer, and then she published it 2 years later in 1818.